Israel, as we were mentioning earlier, under the leadership of Moses, was led out of Egypt. Over a period of years, finally made it to the Promised Land. And here, under the leadership of Joshua, they had a people and a landmass. And it was God's people in God's place, and they had this glorious nation that they had been promised. But over time, going through various things, the people decided that they really wanted to be like other people. They wanted a king. They wanted somebody to go out in front of them to be their leader when they went to battle. In so doing, there was a very definite rejection of Yahweh as king. Samuel very clearly pointed this out. But nevertheless, the people said, "We want a king." And so a king they had. Saul came in as king, and then David, and then Solomon. And Solomon's rebellion in his latter part of his life led to a division of the kingdom. And most of the kingdom was taken and given to, you know, to create a northern kingdom. And then there were two of the tribes to create the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom, while it could have been a great kingdom, it, from the very beginning, started changing the religious tone, and the nation existed for a couple hundred years, but then finally went into captivity, never to be heard of again. The southern kingdom lasted longer, and while there were good kings, there were also bad kings, and over a time of deterioration, finally Babylon was in power, and Babylon started conquering Israel. So in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar was ascending to the throne, and they exerted their force on Jerusalem and captured Jerusalem, and Jerusalem came under the power of Babylon. At that time period, they took some of the more qualified and promising youth to Babylon to serve in the Babylon government. A few years would pass, 7-8 years, and Jerusalem would assert itself again, and Babylon would come back and subdue it greater, more forceful presence. Another 10 years would pass, and again, Jerusalem would try to make some show of force, and Babylon would come for that third and final time in 586 and destroy the temple and destroy the wall and lay Jerusalem in rumbles. God had miraculously delivered Israel, promised it to Abraham. They found themselves in slavery in Egypt, and through Moses there was a miraculous deliverance of this people out. The people rebelled, and there's this 40 years in the wilderness. But even after that, they actually enter the Promised Land. Never to be as great as they could have been, because they never conquered the land the way that God had prescribed for it to be done, but nevertheless, they were a nation. And under David became a grand nation. Under Solomon became a powerful nation. People from out the world came to see Israel and to know of Solomon's wisdom. But yet Solomon's wisdom gave way by his joining together with women that worshipped other gods and bringing those gods in. But there was this glorious nation that had been promised and that would continue. And through various ups and downs, and now that nation is no longer. There is no king. There are no real group of people in Israel. There is no capital city. The walls are broken down. The temple is destroyed. Babylon is in control. No one comes to Israel to see Solomon's great buildings. They don't exist. No one comes to hear the wisdom because it's forgotten. The nation has been decimated. Daniel in 605 was, say, 16 years old, and he went into captivity, educated by the king, put into service by the king, and we've seen some of the things that took place. How he took a stand, and God blessed him, how his friend Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow down to King Nebuchadnezzar's idol, and how God provided for them, and Nebuchadnezzar came to recognize certain things about Yahweh. How God revealed a dream to Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel was the only one that could interpret it, and it gave this scope of history. How Nebuchadnezzar was told ahead of time, but yet still did it, claimed how glorious, how wonderful he was, and God humbled him. And after 7 years, he came back to his right senses and proclaimed to the world that Daniel's God was the God. But yet, Nebuchadnezzar would die. A couple other people would come to throne, and finally a grandson, Belshazzar, would come to throne, and we saw that after he had been on the throne for 14 years or so, that the end of the kingdom came. And it came in a climactic judgment. Handwriting on the wall that only Daniel could interpret, make sense of. Surely others could read it, but it made no sense. And Daniel explained, judgment has happened. Your time is up. Judgment's here. It will be here tonight. And Media Persia came in that night and captured Jerusalem. We saw last week that in the very early days of the reign of Darius and the Medo-Persian rule, that Daniel had been put in a place of authority again. Evidently, during the last years of the Babylon kingdom, he had been put out to pasture, but he had been restored to that, and was even being at a point where he's going to be promoted to be second in charge of the nation. And those conspired against him to try to trick the king and get rid of Daniel. And Daniel's thrown into the lion's den, and to only have apparently the warm coats of the lions to sleep on and snuggle up to all night. But this king was a little different than Nebuchadnezzar, who had said to Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, "There is not even a god that could save you from my hand." Darius had the thought that maybe Daniel would survive. He knew something of Daniel's God. And he hurried to the lion's den the next morning to find out indeed what he hoped for was true. Daniel was alive. And he makes a proclamation similar to Nebuchadnezzar, saying that Daniel's God is the God. The God. Well, as you look at these chapters, and chapters 1 through 6 are historical, and then charting this chapter 7 on, we have this predictive element to Daniel, but it occurs in the historical part, and so there's a kind of a starting over. And in future, we'll look at an overview of that from that perspective. But today, I want to just pause and kind of review Daniel's chapters 2 through 7. And it has, as we review this, to overview this, to have an emphasis on the parallels that are taking place. Now, 2 through 6 are historical, it's chronological, if you would, and then chapter 7 is going to jump back. It's not the historical part, but it ties into these parallels through here. First, if you just look at the chapters, we're looking at 2 through 7. And then you can think of the dates that unfold here, and then the age that Daniel would be during that time period, and the kingdom that is there, and the kings. And so as you look at this, as it, you know, you see Daniel is moving along in his age, maybe 16 years old when he went to Babylon, and he's at the king's court for, say, 3 years before chapter 2 begins. But as we saw last week and the week before, that Daniel, at the time of the end of Babylon to the beginning of Media-Persia taking over, Daniel is in his 80s. Daniel has lived his life, basically, in captivity. And, you know, there are some things we don't know. Chapter 4, you know, when did chapter 4 occur? It was prior to Nebuchadnezzar's death in 562 or 552, so it had to be 10 years before. I don't know. One of my thoughts, and it's just simply a thought, is that after Babylon, after Nebuchadnezzar went in 586 and destroyed Jerusalem, that would probably be a time when this occurred. That would be a time period that God said, okay, you need to be aware of who you are. And Nebuchadnezzar's walking around his palace and, look at me, how wonderful I am. I am the champion of everything. That seems to be a likely time for me, though the text doesn't give us a date. But everything at this point is really involved Babylon, except for chapter 6 was with Media-Persia. But when we move into chapter 7, we're actually going back in time because it's not chronological at this point. We're seeing one of the predictive events that occurred in Daniel's life. And so it backs up to not the end of Babylon, not the... So here in 539, this is when Babylon comes to end, but we're going back to the beginning of Belshazzar's reign. Well, in the next slide, we'll look at some of the events that took place. There are these parallels that take place. You know, in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about the statues. This statue that is made up of these various metals, various components. Chapter 7, Daniel is going to have a vision about four beasts, and those are parallel. They have different focuses, they have different emphasis, but both of them are looking at these four nations and God's kingdom. Then in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar sets up an idol. Has this idea, everybody ought to honor me. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are persecuted because they will not bow down to that. But the end result is Nebuchadnezzar comes to recognize their God as a God that delivers. Chapter 6, Daniel, not the king, but the king's men, if you would, plot against Daniel and persecute Daniel. And Daniel's caught up into the king's law, thrown into a lion's den. But at the end, the king also acknowledges that Daniel's God is a God that delivers. In between these two, we have judgments. Chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream about this great tree. And it turns out to be it's a judgment on Nebuchadnezzar because of his arrogance. And he will be humbled. In chapter 5, there's handwriting on the wall, which is the judgment that comes upon Babylon. And so we see these things have a very definite parallel. There's nothing accidental about the structure here. Very definite. The next slide, I see the same kind of concept that we're really looking at Gentile power in action. This is, the Gentiles are in control of Israel, but there's definite limitations. God is the one that is sovereign. And so in chapter 2 with Nebuchadnezzar's dream about the statue with four metals, it becomes an overall scope of Gentile history. But as we'll see today in chapter 7, it also is an overall scope of Gentile history. But it's that Gentile power. They're in charge of Jerusalem, but not really. There's very clear limitations. In the two chapters in 3 and over here in 6 where the persecution takes place, the end result is God is sovereign. People want to persecute those that bow down to Yahweh, but only find out that Yahweh is the only God that's in charge. And in these two chapters on judgment, Nebuchadnezzar comes to realize in a way that he surely thought he could never come to realize, that Yahweh sets up kingdoms as he is humbled. Belshazzar, the end of the Babylon kingdom, comes to recognize, I assume, he came to recognize, he's clearly told that Yahweh's in charge as that kingdom comes to an end. So God is sovereign. These chapters are telling us very clearly, God is sovereign. The Gentiles are in control of Israel, in one sense, but over them, over any Gentile king, is Yahweh. So Yahweh has not abandoned His people. In the next slide, it's very much the same thing, looking at the same passages, but in chapter 2 and in chapter 7, it's God that reveals. God is the one that reveals this dream to Nebuchadnezzar, and God is the one that reveals this dream to Daniel. In chapter 3 and in chapter 6, it's the men of God or the man of God that is faithful in the face of persecution. And in all of this, shown in both chapters 4 and 5, also in throughout this whole section, it doesn't matter how many wise people there are, it doesn't matter how talented they are, it's only the man of God that can make known God's mysteries. And Daniel never gets caught up in the fame, if you would. Daniel's always very clear, hey, it's not me, it's God. I have no ability, it's God that's doing this. Well, that's the setting as we come into chapter 7. And the question really, if we were going to ask a question at the text at this time, it's, who will rule the world? Who will rule the world? See, and if you were actually at that time period and you're either one that has ended up in Babylon or you're back in Jerusalem or somewhere, you're one of the Jewish people somewhere scattered around, and you're going, wait a minute, I thought God had a plan. I thought Yahweh had a plan and that David's kingdom was going to last forever. What happened to all of this? I mean, Babylon was in control, and now immediate Persia's in control, but this is really back time period when Babylon's still in control. And maybe it looked hope for a while Nebuchadnezzar was coming, you know, every few years, was getting a greater revelation of who Yahweh is. But now King Neb's off the scene, and the kings that are following him, they don't even remember the things that Nebuchadnezzar learned. Well, Daniel has a vision. In the first three verses, it says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and the four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. And so Daniel's vision is about four beasts. Four great beasts that are in verses 4 to 8. And these beasts are, it's all imagery in the sense that he says, it was like it. Daniel saw something in this vision, and he's trying to relate it to his audience, and the best he can come up with is say, well, this one looks kind of like this, this one looks a little bit like this. You know, one looked like a lion, but it's not really a lion, it's a winged lion. It's like, it's a part lion and part eagle. It's these great leaders. You know, the greatest bird, representative bird would be an eagle, the greatest animal would be a lion, and so it's a lion eagle, as he definitely is looking at Babylon, and more specifically at Nebuchadnezzar. And then he comes up and he says, well, the next one is like a bear. Well, it's not really a bear, but it's kind of like a bear, but it's this bear that's kind of, you know, up on one side, and given maybe the idea that, you know, it's Medo-Persia, which we'd come to, you know, later recognize, and it's one is more dominant than the other one. And he talks about these three ribs in his mouth, and so here's this bear that's devouring things, and as it came into power, it devoured Lydia and Egypt and Babylon, and so maybe that's the reference. And then he says, and then comes this leopard, and it's a winged leopard. It's got four wings, and oh yeah, it's got four heads. And you're kind of thinking, well, you know, if you're going to say that, would you say the leopard had four heads and then four wings? And why? How would you say it, a leopard? And kind of, it's, you know, kind of the way it described it seems to be backwards. And the idea of a leopard would be that it's very swift and fast, which fit Greece. And as we look at it, and definitely if you were at this time period looking forward, I don't think you would say, anybody would be going, okay, this is going to be a country that's going to come in very fast and conquer the world, and then, oh yeah, the four heads mean it's going to divide up into four kingdoms. I don't think it's that kind of predictive history. You're going to see it ahead of time. But as you look back, you say, you can see this, okay, here's this country that came in afterwards, and it conquered the world very quickly. A leopard is a good description of it. And, you know, this winged leopard, it's very fast, but then you put these four heads, and you put them at the end of the description, and after Alexander the Great, the four generals divided up the kingdom. And it just starts to fit. And so it's predictive history, but not necessarily predictive history in that if you were in front of it, you would be saying, clearly outlined, oh, this is what's going to happen, as much as it is that as it unfolds, you're saying, oh, yeah, this is exactly what God said was going to happen. And as you look back, it's incredible to say, wow, this is what God said was going to happen. It's so incredibly accurate that those that are of a liberal persuasion say Daniel had to be written very late. It had to be written way after all of this took place because it's way too accurate. And we couldn't have predictive concepts here, so it had to be after the fact. Somebody, a pseudo-Daniel, was looking back in history and said, you know, I think a good way to describe Greece would be a leopard. And you know, it had these four kings, and a good way to describe those would be four heads. That's how accurate. They recognize it so accurate, but they have to have a different explanation than you and I would accept. Well, he moves on from there, and he, having said, they're like this, they're like this, they're like this, he comes up to a dreadful beast. And see, when you're looking at these beasts and you're saying, well, one's like a leopard, one's like a bear, one's like a lion, but not really a lion, it's a lion with an eagle's wings. It's not really a bear, it's a bear with, you know, kind of raised up on one side and ribs in its mouth. It's like a leopard, but the leopard's got wings. At least there's something there you can relate to. Notice when he comes to this one. In verse 7 he says, after this, I kept looking in night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. And it had large iron teeth. I mean, he can't even come up, you know, teeth is the only thing that he can come up with that even relates to any kind of an image. This is such a dreadful beast that you can't explain it. As he ain't trying to say, well, it's kind of like. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up from among them. And the three of the first horns were pulled out by its roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boast. And so here's this fourth beast, which we would identify with the Roman Empire, but not just the historic Roman Empire, but a revived Roman Empire, because it moves from Rome to a gap of time, which we would call the Church Age, to the end. And some other passages make that a little more clear. But in the end, there will be these 10 horns, 10 kings. But as those 10 kings emerge, then there will be another that will emerge and take 3 of those and displace them. And then it will move into even a dominance. So it's a small horn, in meaning it started small, not that it stays small. It actually becomes very large because it becomes the dominant king. And it puts himself in a position of power and authority and the arrogance that we would have seen in Nebuchadnezzar. That, look at this, everything is me. Everything's about me. But then Daniel's vision goes to another direction, to the Ancient of Days in verses 9 to 12. I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head was pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. His wheels were burning fire. A river of fire was flowing, and coming out of before him, thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. And as for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away. But the extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. And so we see here that while these kingdoms are dominant and powerful and they rule, there's another. And he's more powerful. The Ancient of Days, God himself. His kingdom is powerful. And then he introduces the Son of Man. And the Son of Man in Daniel is very clearly a messianic title. And Jesus Christ will pick this title to be his title. His preferred title will be the Son of Man. Exactly why he chose this title would only be speculation, but the speculation that I would have is that the titles of the Messiah and the concept of what the Messiah was to be was so clear and so mistaken. People said, oh, it's a political Messiah. It's a deliverer that's going to come and deliver us from Rome right now. And it was all about political freedom. And Jesus comes in and he picks out this title from Daniel, which was not a well-used title of the Messiah. And he put it to himself because he's redefining the Messiah as God had defined it. And so his preferred title was the Son of Man. And here in verses 13 to 14 we see this. He says, I kept looking in the night vision, and behold, with the cloud of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming, and he came upon the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, a kingdom, that all the peoples, nation, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And so, in contrast to these kings, these powerful kings, kings that conquered the world, kings that were the dominant human figure, oh yeah, there's one. And he never passes away. And so if you're listening to Daniel, and your question is, well, what's happening? I thought God had made a promise. And then it's, oh yeah, he's going to keep that promise. Yeah, we're in a time when Gentiles are in control. And there's going to be this kingdom, and this kingdom, and this kingdom, and this kingdom. But the Son of Man, the appointed king, the one from David, he will reign, and no one will take that kingdom away from him. He moves there to an interpretation of the four beasts in 15 through 18. And And as he doesn't go through them exactly, just, you know, verse 17, these are great beasts which are four in number. There are four kings who arise from the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. See, that's the point. Yeah, there are these kings. Here's the scope of history. These Gentile kings will reign over Israel. But, and that's the important part, the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom. And then he says that he wanted to know exactly about this fourth beast. 19, he says, then I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. Because it was different. It was dreadful. And as he goes through this, verse 23, it says, the fourth beast will be the fourth kingdom on earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the four horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and will subdue 3 kings. And he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one, and he will intend to make alterations in times and law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and a half time. And so we start to see some of the numbering that will go with other numbering and with Revelation. A time, you know, one period of time. Times, which would be understood as 2 periods of times, and a half a time. So we end up with 3.5 years, you know, and with other dating of the tribulation period, which is 7 years, we see this is half of the tribulation period. That this one, this little horn that becomes this big horn, that becomes the Antichrist, that is this dominant historical, or will not historical in the sense of past, but will be a future person, a real person in real time, that will be wanting everything to revolve around him. And all life will be about him to the extent that he can make that true. He will speak out against the Most High. He will wear down the saints. But in verse 26, but the court will sit in judgment, and his dominion will be taken away from him, annihilated and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. Do you realize what it would be like? You're in captivity. You've maybe heard things. Maybe somebody's got this inside and saying, well, you know, I think it's only going to last 70 years. There's this, this, this. And you might believe it. You might not believe it. Maybe you've never heard of that. What's happened? I thought God had promised us a kingdom forever. And Daniel comes along and says, yeah, well, there's going to be this kingdom, there's going to be this kingdom, there's going to be this kingdom, there's going to be this fourth kingdom. And out of this fourth kingdom, things are going to get really weird as these 10 kings come. But then this one person is going to take over, and he's going to be unlike anybody else. And he's going to speak out against God in a way that nobody's ever spoken out against God. But he's going to be set aside, and all of that glory and authority is going to be given back to God's people. What a promise. Now, if you're sitting there and you're thinking and you're listening to this, you're going, well, I'm not going to see that. You're talking about lots of kingdoms there. I'm not going to see that. Boy, you do have this promise. You don't have this. Not a promise in the sense of like, you know, just, well, it's nice to think about. But there's an assurance. Okay, this is not the way it's going to end. I mean, we blew it. We were God's kingdom. And we pushed them out and we said, we don't want you to be our king. And then we went into captivity. But it's all going to be restored. He is faithful to His Word. And what's so incredible to me in this last part is that the way verse 27 is written. then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints. Now, if you're reading this for the very first time, and the words are, you know, popping up on the screen, you're not able to look ahead, it's then the sovereignty, the dominion, the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the Son of Man. Will be given to the Son of David. But here it's given back to His people. Now over them will reign the Son of Man. But look at the position that God places His people in. What care, what concern. And this is for a group that rejects Him. You know, people are not faithful. We'd like to be faithful. But people are not historically faithful. God is faithful. God is faithful. And that gives us great hope and great promise and great prospect. And so we come at it from a different angle. We're not at a time of captivity. We're not looking forward to these four kingdoms. Actually, we're in this gap. And so the four kingdoms have taken place, but yet there's a period of where there's going to be a revived Roman Empire and these 10 kings, and this Antichrist will come upon the throne. But we're still at that point of saying, okay, when things look bad, when it looks like God's people are losing, when someone comes on the scene and pushes all of God's people away and convinces the whole world there isn't a God except Him, don't lose faith. Don't lose the thought. Keep in mind that all of the dominion, all the glory is going to be given back to God's people. And the Son of Man will reign upon the earth. Daniel concludes, he says, at this point the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. So there's a period of time that Daniel didn't relate this, but then there came a time that he did, as God directed him, and he laid it out in this book. But the book is unfolded in such a way that we see these parallel things. There's a scope of Gentile history. To Nebuchadnezzar it was revealed, this is what Gentile history will look like. And that one is really set up for those kings. Those kings need to recognize that Yahweh is in control. Now, Gentile kings, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, you're one of them. You're the first one. You're going to reign over my people. But never forget, I'm in control. This last one is the same thing, but the focus is different. The focus isn't that the Gentile king needs to know it. It's the people of God need to know that there's a scope of history. And Yahweh's in control. He has not abandoned His people. He has a plan. He still has a plan. And some reason beyond anything I can ever figure out, He's included me. He's included you. What a glorious position. What a privileged position. Will you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we thank You so much for Your Word. And there's so much in this chapter, and we could spend so many days looking at all the details and looking at history and mapping it all out. And it would be a great study, and it would be a worthwhile study. But there's also the truth in this chapter that You're in charge. We can read it, we can look at the different details, but when it's all said and done each time, is that You're in charge of history. Help us to have a confidence in You that allows us to lead our life in uncertain times, because we know that those days are certain with You. even though they're so often beyond the scope of our imagination. And we do pray in Christ's name. Amen.